Nadia Nagamutu, thank you so much for joining me today. So for people that don't know you, you are a chartered psychologist and the founder of a company called Avenir, which we will talk about a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And it would be lovely if we could discuss both your own experiences, but also what your kind of professional experience and stance is on women in midlife.
Yeah.
So thank you for joining.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you.
So maybe, I don't know if you've got a preference about where to start, but I know that if you're happy to, your own kind of personal experiences of kind of being a woman in midlife have been, there's been challenges. And I wondered if you were happy to share a bit about what had happened.
It'd be a bit of a rubbish episode if I said no, actually, at this point, wouldn't it?
Well, feel free to not share anything you don't want to share, or just what you're comfortable with.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's really odd, actually. I'm 44 now, and I feel like the conversation around menopause is so needed, but I still feel, is it really relevant to me? I'm only 44, and yet over the last year, I've definitely felt different to how I felt before that. There wasn't a point in time where I started feeling different, but certainly, this is too young, surely, 44. And yet what plays in my mind is when, like in my 30s, my husband and I were trying for children and we had trouble conceiving, and it was really, really challenging, because especially when you're in your 30s, is that period where you're going to lots of weddings, and then before you know it, you know, there's babies coming along. And so whilst we did have our wedding, there was no baby that came along, certainly not for the first, well, I think it was it took 2 years for us to conceive and have Ilana, then our first baby. And that was hard, because actually we went through all the tests and nothing was wrong. Everything should have been fine. Everything's in good working order. Okay, great. And it was really frustrating and often heartbreaking. Mm. And a lot of people, and there's a real societal, I suppose, expectation that, you know, you meet someone, then it's like, when's the wedding? Has he proposed yet? What's, you know, and I was like, you know, and then once you do get married, oh, you know, so any news? It was almost like every...
Did people ask you?
Almost every week, at least once. And when I relayed this to my husband, he wasn't getting anything. He was never getting asked any questions. It was only me that was being asked. And of course, when you're going through that whole sort of the cycle of, oh, well, you know, it could be this month, you never know. And then, you know, you're trying, and then I'm waiting towards the end of the cycle, just, you know, seeing any sign that maybe it's possible, maybe I'm not bleeding this month. And then, of course, the low when my period, you know, came. And that's over 2 years. It's not actually that long, 2 years, but it feels like it when you're in it.
Yeah. Especially when everybody else is getting pregnant easily around you.
And then you just see every pregnant woman that's on earth that walks past you. It's just like, why are there so many pregnant women around? And then after having our first daughter, I was studying. I did an executive MBA at Henley. And it was an opportunity that came. I actually won a scholarship to do it. And I was like, oh gosh, I can't, you know, this is amazing. Let me do it. I started the exec MBA when she was 10 months, actually. And a lot of judgment on that. A lot of some, you know, friends saying how brave I was, and, you know, other comments going, oh, you know, you really should take the whole maternity leave. Because I went back to work at 10 months as well. But my husband took shared parental leave. So I tag team him. He was the main carer, and I went to work, and then I was doing the exec MBA, and I was like, she's not with anyone else apart from her dad. And yeah. Oh, the first year of the baby's life is so important. And I was getting lots of, are you not worried that, you know, the bonding with your baby, that if you're absent for so much? And I'm like, you know, it was a lot. Because I prioritized who was
commenting? Was it friends or family or work colleagues?
Friends mainly. People who I was quite surprised about, but people I was close enough to that they were able to ask whether I was concerned about, you know. And I was like, it's a lot. There was a lot of judgment, and under the surface, sort of like little questions and things. So I prioritized that. And so then the guilt and there's a lot of shame around it as well. When we were trying for our second baby, it took 4 years. There was a point where I thought there was many stories I'd heard where women were telling me that they had found it difficult to conceive the first time. And the second time it just happened.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay. So it's going to be fine because my body knows what it's doing now. And I don't have this strange thing in my head that maybe once it's done it once, it will just do it again. And so then that was another painful, but it was twice as long with a miscarriage, in the sense that we had a positive pregnancy test after 2 years. And a couple of days later, I had a heavy bleed.
That
was 2 years. Yeah. So I was really low, like I couldn't stop crying at that point. That was really devastating, just because I was like, oh, you know, we were sort of like, oh, maybe we just can only do it every 2 years, you know. Yeah. And then, you know, and so we were so delighted, because actually when we conceived the first time, that was the baby we had.
Yeah.
So I didn't even think. I just didn't think. So then when we lost it, it was really not this ever good timing, but it was really bad timing, because it was Christmas time and we'd gone to Legoland and to stay overnight, because our eldest still does love Lego. And so we were at Legoland, and so I was trying to be really happy, and you know, we booked in to see Father Christmas and everything, and that's the morning of when the bleed happened. Anyway, I just remember it so distinctly. And then it was another 2 years, and we at that point lots of tests, and then what they told me was that I had a low ovarian count at that point.
And how old were you at that point?
So I was 37.
Right.
37. And so, again, nothing wrong with us biologically, but I had they said there's nothing we can do about that. Mm. You just got a low ovarian count. But so actually you've got less time. And so, oh my gosh, it just added to the pressure. And it also added to that feeling of guilt. And there's something within me that just felt like an absolute failure.
Because it wasn't in your control.
I couldn't do anything about it. Or I was trying to. I mean, we did do lots of things. I went for acupuncture to help, you know, to help with my system and just, you know, balance. And I don't know what she did, but she put some needles in me. And I was eating, I tried to do as much as I could to, you know, nourish my body, for example, that sort of thing, meditating. I had like a guided meditation that was specifically for getting pregnant. I was doing like yoga. I was trying everything
that you possibly could.
Right, which is very me. But equally, there that shame I was talking about was around, but I'm a woman and my body should be able to do this, and it's not doing it. And I really feel ashamed about that. Mm. Like I'm not good enough. I'm not doing what this is supposed to happen. No, you know,
like why isn't it working?
And so that was really, it was really tough. So that low ovarian count at 37, does that mean, and this is a question for you, I suppose, does that mean that I'm more likely to have an earlier menopause?
Essentially, yes, because you're So your ovarian reserve is a marker of how many eggs you've got left in your ovaries, and the number of eggs that you've got left will dictate your ovarian function and hormonal production. And the hormonal production is or the lack of hormones is what gives you symptoms. So if you've got a low ovarian reserve, then you're likely to experience symptoms younger than somebody whose ovarian reserve would be deemed as normal on investigation. I mean, it doesn't mean that you won't have your last period at 51, but you might notice that you've got that you have a longer period of kind of perimenopausal symptoms.
Yes.
Or it might just mean that because you've been told that you're more in tune with changes that for somebody else they didn't notice.
Yeah, which is where the psychology comes in. I mean, is it possible that my ovarian reserve count at 37 when they did that test, that it was, would it have been compared with like a group of people who have a similar background to me, or would it be compared with just women in general? So is it possible that actually it was a normal ovarian count for someone of my heritage?
It's hard to know without knowing what it was. But if you're, so it is, it's normal from the age of 35 to have a declining ovarian function and ovarian reserve.
Yeah.
So we know that there is a very sharp decline after the age of 35. But it probably meant that you had a less of an ovarian reserve than other 37-year-olds.
Just what I've had often in the health system is that sort of, and I'm never sure, I walk away going, should I be worried about this? Or have they just compared me with people who are different to me?
Have you got any other examples of when that's happened?
Gosh, that's a good question.
I think that it happens a lot just for women being compared to the male system.
Right.
But then there is also that, you know, the comparison of, you know, women from different backgrounds have different experiences of menopause, different periods, different fertility experiences, experiences of pain, they're treated differently when they go into hospital. You know, black women are much more likely to die postnatally or in childbirth than white women. You know, there's
a big
differences.
Investigation going on into that at the moment, isn't there?
Because it's a very stark difference. Women who where English is not their first language, have a massively higher rate of mortality than native English speakers.
And this comes to the work that I do day in, day out in terms of diversity, equity and inclusion. And it really speaks to the equity of diversity, equity, inclusion piece. So, you know, there's something within the system that plays out that, say, you just picked up on language, you know, where someone has an accent. Even if English isn't their first language, it's harder to understand them, harder to read. Like, our brains, essentially as humans, we're just lazy people.
Yeah.
We're just lazy. And so if my brain, as your doctor, is having to work hard to understand you, I'm just not, something within us just kind of either switches off, doesn't listen as much, is less likely to offer the same service as someone who is articulate and clear. And we also, which is really interesting, we relate accent and language to social standing, intelligence, level of education. You might have a really intelligent person whose English isn't their first language, but don't treat them like they're stupid. And this is...
And then it leads to adverse outcome, doesn't it? So tell me more about your job and Avenir.
So I set up Avenir 10 years ago, and in that time then we've been working with global organisations to support creating more diverse and inclusive workplaces, whether that's working with the boards and senior leaders, opening up new conversations around what it means to be inclusive, holding some of their discomfort in that space, because it's not easy. It's not easy to think about yourself as having bias, that has having showing preferential mm. treatment for some people and not others.
Yeah.
Because we really want to be good people. We yeah. want to be good leaders. They want to be good. I'm sure they all want to be good doctors. But how in that moment, if they aren't, if they do have negative or, you know, not so good feelings towards LGBTQ plus based on our past conversation, how do they really know that they're offering the same level of mm. service? And that's a real discomfort that, you know, people can often feel. It's like when they're questioned about it, they'd like to go, oh, no, I'm as inclusive as it gets. I'm, mm. you know, I don't see their sexuality. I just treat them as the people they are. Or I don't see that she's has brown colour skin. I just treat her for whatever. Really? Really? Because I think we need to be honest with ourselves. And this, you know, thinking about the workplace, which is obviously we spend a lot of time supporting leaders, and looking at, well, let's look at the makeup of your organisation. Why is it that certain people are more successful and are more likely to get promoted? And you can see the trend if you look at the pattern in your organisation. Why is it? Is it just by chance? Is it just because all of the white men are really, mm. really, really talented?
Interesting.
Let's just be honest.
The world is designed for men, isn't it?
The world is designed.
Women were a kind of afterthought.
Exactly. Because we entered the workplace yeah. later. But let's face it, we've been in the workplace for quite some time now. Yeah. And yet, because no one's taking a magnifying glass and really looking for these inequities. I mean, it's a small inequity. Okay, so we have to wear a few more layers. But actually, if you think about optimizing productivity and performance, we know that we perform better if we're comfortable, mm. if we are in, you know, comfortable surroundings where we're not thinking, you know, oh my gosh, my fingers are freezing, I have to type. Of course. You know, and that's just one small yeah. example.
So what should, so thinking kind of with our menopause hats on, how, if there, so people, so if you've got kind of midlife women at work, how best should they approach their senior leaders to
yeah,
improve?
And I would turn that question a little bit, because I think it's firstly on the organisation and the organisational leaders to make themselves accessible and make it very clear that they want to learn and they want to understand, that they won't have all the answers, and that they don't want it to be that someone's sitting there with freezing cold hands mm. because the temperature's not quite right for them, as an analogy to just all the inequities as a woman that you would have to face in an organisational context because you're a woman, and just purely because the organisation was designed by men for men. So we need some humility and curiosity from the very top of the organisation to go, we understand that the system was designed by people like us, and we want everyone here, everyone, to feel comfortable, as productive as they can be, able to do their job as best they can, and fulfilled in their role to be able to fulfill their potential. And in order to do that, we need you to talk to us. And they need to be able to role model that when someone does share a story, that they're able to take that story with the sensitivity and respect that it deserves and say, I didn't realise that that was the case. And I'm sorry that that's what you experience here. What can we do mm. to support you? What are some of the solutions that we can work through? Now, and this is where a lot of leaders and where that whole kind of, oh, it's woke, gone, you know, it's gone too far, the pendulum swung, now we have to do everything that everyone asks for. How are we supposed to run an organisation when you've got all these different demands from different people? Are we supposed to just bow down and do everything? No, that's not what being inclusive means. Being inclusive is the curiosity and the willingness to be open. Once you have the safety within the organisation, where you have these leaders role modelling what it means to be open to new realities, new truths, then you hope that with that psychological safety within the organization, that you can create communication where people feel safe to be able to share. And that's where women really, you know, who are experiencing menopause or menstruation pains or, you know, just difficulty with women things that might not, by the organization might not be designed to see and help them manage and support them with, there should be a path or an avenue for them to take. And sometimes it can be the women's network. You know, there are, I mean, it's, I think networks, employee resource groups, whatever they're called, affinity groups, I think they're brilliant for, you know, sometimes actually they're actually menopause networks as well, which is wonderful. Because then you feel like women can then feel like they can talk openly within a safe, really safe space within their organization, be heard. But where they work even better is when there is a senior level sponsor who dedicates their time to really amplifying the voice and the stories of those people. So if women are experiencing, I mean, maybe you can tell me some of the symptoms that often women experience in the workplace that might be a barrier to them being productive, that those stories are heard and it gets taken to the top table and something's done with it and they're given a budget and, you know, it needs to be resourced.
Yeah, I think it's the difficulty is kind of getting the senior leaders to, like, how do you get the senior leaders to know about it? Especially if there's a culture of, this is how we've always done things and it's always been fine in the past. Have you got any tips on how you break through that first, like, barrier? Especially in, you know, there's in those kind of corporations where it's not been done before.
So organization, if they have some senior women at the top who are able to speak from a lived experience, from their own reality of having experienced menopause or perimenopause, then say, for example, within, if it has to be senior level women, because that's really powerful. And then you create a panel conversation. There's an event, you know, and it can be for, you know, International Women's Day or Menopause Month or whatever, but just create an event that's relevant to the organization where you can create space and invite as many people as possible, not just the women in the organization, to hear. And that vulnerability, that ability for those senior women to share their experiences, it changes culturally. You can't tangibly understand the impact that has. But for the women in the organization to feel validated, to feel safe, to look at these women, look at, you know, the position they are in the organization and they're sharing their stories. That makes it okay for me to share my story and know that it's not going to impact my career. And that's one of the biggest fears is that women feel it's going to affect how they're viewed, how they're treated.
Absolutely. It can be a target on your back, can't it? If you stand up and admit that, you know, you've got brain fog and you can't find your words and you're feeling anxious about giving that presentation and you left your keys and you can't find, you know, it's like, how can you do your job then? Like,
That's a big question mark over it.
Even if you stand up and you're an advocate for the other women in your practice, then you are highlighting yourself as somebody that there's a reason why you might not be performing well. Exactly. And if you're not, you know, then all eyes are on you and, you're not performing as well as your counterpart. Well, why would we keep you when we can find somebody else that will?
Exactly. And so this is why it's so important to start with the very top of the organization, because even the most senior women won't do what the organization needs to create the safety and the cultural shift. Even the senior women won't lift their head above the parapet, so to speak, and actually share their story unless they feel that it's safe to do so and their job won't be affected. So that's why it's so important for the very top of the organization for it to be really, and that it could take a year plus to create that level of safety. So don't be surprised if you put on an event and no one's really sharing and it's a bit of a, organizations want a really quick fix. And like, oh, well, we did something for, you know, Menopause Month. We did something for International Women's Day.
And have you seen it working? Have you seen the positives?
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. There's some really amazing organizations where the leaders, they don't just say the right things, they also do it. Mm. And they genuinely, hand on heart, want for their organization, want for everyone in their organization to have a positive experience and to be able to fulfill their potential. I mean, to be honest, it's a bit of a no-brainer. Why wouldn't any leader want that for their people? Otherwise, you know, you're not getting the return on investment from a bottom line business case. You're not getting a return on investment from your people. So to me, it doesn't make, it makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah. I guess quick fixes, isn't it?
We're lazy.
Yeah.
It comes back to it.
Yeah. So you mentioned that your 30s were all about hormones and getting pregnant and a kind of cycle of disappointment and other people's opinions on why you weren't getting pregnant and having babies. What are you hoping for your 40s? Or fearing even?
Yeah. Or oh, it's a really good, I don't know. It's a good question. So with my 40s, so they're definitely, so that we have our family, really beautiful family. And so that's about enjoying that time. But at the same time, what I'm finding now, and maybe it's because of my low ovarian reserve, but I'm 44 and there are times in the, I don't know, it's only been 6 months where I can't get the word. Like, it's a really, like, it's there, but it's not there. And I believe it's brain fog, but I think I'm in denial about it because I'm like, I'm 44. Like, this is, and, you know, bearing in mind, again, I pride myself on being quick. I'm quick-minded. I'm smart. You know, these are all the things that I have as labels for me.
Yeah.
And I'm on stage and I'm talking and I'm speaking now, right? How can I be, I can't, and I'm delivering workshops, I'm facilitating conversations with like global leaders. I can't not find, you know, and so it's the times where I really have to, it takes me a few seconds before I just have to try and find a workaround to this word is not coming to my, it's just not appearing for me. It's so uncomfortable. I'm not used to that.
Does it worry you?
It worries me hugely. What if it hasn't actually happened in a real, like it's happened within client meetings, but never on stage or, I don't know if it's going to get worse. So I suppose that to answer your question, there's a little bit of a fear. If this is happening at 44, you know, as I approach 45, 40s, you know, what is this going to continue? Is it going to stop at some point? Is there anything I can do about it? And also, you know, my periods are now not regular. It was very regular. Had a shorter cycle than most, but it was very regular, spot on. And the last 6 months again, like, I'm like, where is this thing? Like, what I'm holding on here? And it's almost like that. So that's, again, it's like this concern, I suppose, about what's happening in my body that I have no control over.
Yes.
That I'm like, I should, you know, if I just crack on and just, you know, this is very
me. And does
that
worry you as well? That your periods aren't what they used to be? Or do you kind of know what's happening and feel comfortable with it? Or
I wish I knew more what was happening. Mm. I wish there was a way of kind of just getting a complete kind of just scan. I have gone for bloods. And the doctor did say I had a bit of a low iron level, but I don't know if that impacts. I have been feeling a little bit fatigued as well, actually. So I'm waking up. I had an undisturbed night's sleep, despite a four-year-old kind of in the house who regularly comes. If it's a miracle when she doesn't come, you know, in the middle of the night, I've slept all the way through. Yeah. And I'm like, why am I still waking up tired? So there's a part of me in my 40s now where I'm a little bit concerned that I won't be the person that I've always been, or that I've been known to be, or that I pride myself on, or so my identity, will my identity need to shift? Will I have to adapt because of what my body's doing?
And are you worried that you're just going to get more and more symptoms and it's just going to be an increasing like decline?
I thought hadn't actually popped into my mind until you'd said
sorry.
That. Oh no. get worse.
Sorry.
Well, I guess from the symptoms that I currently have, I think I'm in denial that I actually am perimenopausal. Mm. I think it's just, I'm just very much like, oh, it must just be a thing that's happening at the moment and then it will go away. But I think that might be just more hope than reality.
And have you had any other symptoms?
No.
No hot flushes or
no. No, all good.
Because your period's changing like that and the fact that you've had additional symptoms do support that it, you know, could easily be it could easily be perimenopause.
I thought you were going to say that.
It's, yeah, I mean, and that's the thing, because it's so, it's just so kind of, it comes and goes and it's a bit vague and, you know, especially word finding difficulties. It's a very woolly symptom. You know, you could say, well, I was stressed or I didn't sleep the night before,
right,
or I was hungover or I was, you know, it's hard to quantify, but it could easily be, especially if you knew that at 37 you had a low ovarian reserve.
Right.
So
so how do we actually find, is there anything that you can do to get sort of a health once over so that they can actually say for sure, yes, you know, I can see that your estrogen or progesterone levels are here and actually at this level, perimenopause is likely.
It's not as easy as that because your hormones will be constantly changing.
Oh.
You can do blood tests, especially in the under 45s. We do blood tests partly to exclude other causes. You know, like your GP did one to check your iron for fatigue. I mean, it's totally appropriate. And you might find that you've got a low estrogen and you might find that you've got a high FSH, or you might not. But if you don't, it doesn't necessarily mean that these are not perimenopause symptoms.
Oh, right.
And some, you know, you might think, well, this is really impacting me at work. I want to try some HRT. And some, you know, one woman in your position might say yes. Another woman in your position might prefer not to. It's very individual. It's very individual.
Okay.
But because you are relatively young, then you know, the advantage to using estrogen might be greater than, say, if you were kind of 48, 49 for bone protection, cardiovascular protection. So it's definitely worth considering or having a kind of further discussion at some point. And sometimes symptoms will just complete. You might find that come tomorrow, everything goes back to normal, your symptoms disappear, your periods become regular, and it was just a blip, because that's how ovaries work. They don't follow textbooks.
And I have to say, that's what I'm hoping for. Like, you know, this is always this bit of hope that I'm like, oh, it's just a point in time and, you know, there's lots going on at the moment. And I think there is part of me that's just in denial about the whole perimenopausal thing. I've got time for that.
And that's it. Who has got time for
right.
it? It's an inconvenience.
It's a huge inconvenience. You know, it's me. I'm doing my thing, you know. And it just feels like it's going to get in the way. And that's probably the biggest concern for my 40s, I would say, is that, like, you know, did the whole focus on the baby thing, you know, got to 40, had my littlest and just gone, yes, right, we're here.
Yeah.
Let's enjoy it.
So you spend your 20s trying to not get pregnant.
Yes.
Your 30s trying to get pregnant, and your 40s, grappling with perimenopause. And so maybe it's like 50 all the way. Yeah. So kind of with your psychology hat on, do you have any like suggestions or tips or tricks for how women can frame the kind of challenges that hormones bring?
It's a really interesting one. And in psychology, and certainly in sort of therapy world, actually, there's a cognitive behavioral approach, which is called acceptance commitment therapy. I don't know if you've come across it before. And I suppose I'm leaning a little bit on that when I'm speaking to it, although I'm not a clinical psychologist. Is this sense of, so if we accept, if we really work psychologically to accept what's happening within us, to our bodies hormonally, and the outcomes of that, the brain fog, that I might struggle to find a word every now and then, that I might wake up and still feel a bit tired, but accept it as part of you, that it's okay. So you, by rejecting it, you're rejecting part of you, who you are. And that reframing is really powerful, because rather than actually, and we do it with our emotions, you know, when we feel fear or anger or frustration or any emotion that we might deem as bad emotions, we don't like feeling them. So we push them to one side, stamp on them nice and hard, and then hope that they'll go away. So the acceptance commitment approach is very much around, like, I accept that I have fear here around this, and I accept that my body is doing something that I don't know anything about or what it feels like, and that, and I accept that who I know I am might have to shift and change as I grow older and as I do, as I go about my life and my day to day. And, you know,
it's a lovely way of thinking about it. Because a lot of the narrative is about pushing against it.
Yes, exactly.
You know, take something to fix it. HRT will fix it. Lifestyle will fix it. This will sort you out. You need to be doing this. You need to be not doing that. Whereas actually...
And it doesn't mean you shouldn't do all of that stuff and care for yourself. And, you know, we know strength-based training is really important. We know, you know, movement and breathing and, you know, there's lots of things, taking some supplements. I'm not saying don't do that. But from a psychological perspective, that's all feeding the body. But, you know, mind and soul and, you know, it's all connected. So unless we're working on our mind at the same time as working on our body, we're not going to do ourselves service if we're constantly fighting to get rid of the symptoms as opposed to accepting that they're there, still taking the supplements and still doing the work on our bodies, but knowing that this is an important part of growing older and being the next version of you.
Who I'm becoming.
Exactly.
So one of the reasons why I wanted to make this podcast was so we could connect with the kind of menopause community or midlife community and take their questions and answer them directly. So thank you for helping me to answer some of these questions. This one is from Priyal, who says, I'm a 45-year-old South Asian mum working in the finance industry. I often find myself in rooms and meetings surrounded by older men. As I enter perimenopause, I find my workplace more and more uncomfortable. The brain fog, the brain freeze, and hot flushes. I honestly can't tell my line manager what is going on with me. How can I get some support? And we see this a lot.
This is a common thing, is just feeling really isolated. And that's really tough when it is very male, masculine team that you're working in, or just a male dominated environment. It's like, are they going to understand? They're probably not going to understand. And we have to assume that we just need to cover up. But yeah, it can really feel quite scary in the workplace when you don't have that level of support that you really need. Now, here is where I would hope that there were some other women in the workplace that she's either friends with or can discuss with. And sometimes, even if they're not in the same place as you, maybe they're not perimenopausal themselves, just talking to other women. And that's the whole purpose of things like the affinity or employee resource groups. It's just sometimes from a mental health and a well-being perspective, just talking to someone who we feel safe talking to, that has similar but maybe different issues to us, but just that we can connect with human to human, woman to woman, is really powerful. So isolation and loneliness and fear are not nice places to be, especially in your work, in the workplace. And we can't possibly be at our best if we're in that place. And if we don't feel we're able to share it, then other people, best case, just won't know we're feeling that. Worst case, will look at us and go, what is up with her? Like, she's really, did you see her in that meeting? That was really bad. Like, we'll start making judgments about us. And then that's a terrible self-fulfilling prophecy. And you're just in this cycle then of people then having lesser expectations of you, you questioning yourself, low self-esteem, low self-worth. You know, from a psychological perspective, it's really damaging. And so if she's at a point where she recognizes this is what's going on for me, and I'm feeling detached from people, and I'm feeling this is what I'm experiencing, and I can't speak to anyone, even if there's someone outside of work to share that with. Ideally, there's someone in her team or line or someone who...
Or people team.
Exactly. Someone internally who she can feel safe sharing that with. But also don't just go with, this is how I'm feeling. I mean, definitely share how you're feeling. But also, this is what potentially would make it a bit better. Mm. This is what I need. So often we're good at saying what we don't want. We're not very good at saying what we do want. Mm. Like, this is how I'm feeling. I don't want this. Well, if you're going to an HR colleague or someone in the people team, they can only help you if you've got some idea of what would make it better.
Yeah. That's good advice. So if people would like to know more about what you do or how they can find you, what's the best way for them to reach you?
Yeah. So I've got lots of different ways people can access me. So I am on socials. So I'm on LinkedIn and I'm on Insta, just Nadia Nagamutu. It's quite a distinct name, so it's really easy to find me. I also have a podcast show myself, which is called Why Care, and it's coming into its sixth season now. So 6 years of Why Care.
Wow.
Talking about diversity, equity, inclusion, thought-provoking conversations with incredible thought leaders and influencers in the space. So I'm really privileged to have those conversations. And my book came out last year, so Beyond Discomfort, Why Inclusive Leadership is So Hard and What You Can Do About It. So more than happy to talk to anyone who wants to have conversations around inclusive leadership or organizational inclusion.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay.